From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
Governor Jerry Brown has presented his final budget plan to the legislature. What are his priorities in his last year as governor? Building more reserves? Spending more money on schools and community colleges? Are there any new infrastructure proposals? We'll find out from the state's acknowledged budget expert, Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst. And then we'll get political analysis from John Myers of the LA Times and Dan Walters of Cal Matters.
We'll also hear from Mike Dunbar, the editorial page editor of the Modesto Bee and the Merced Sun Star, and California State University Bakersfield professor Ivy Cargyle.
Governor Brown's last budget. Caution despite surplus.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. Chevron's Coalinga oil field and Fresno County have been doing side by side for over 100 years. Learn more at doers.com. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. The governor's presented his 2018-19 budget proposal to the legislature. What are the governor's priorities, and will the state's revenues be sufficient to cover the state's short and long-term expenses? Our guest is Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst and the authoritative voice on the budget, a nonpartisan voice on the state budget. Welcome back to the Matty Report.
Thank you, Mark.
So let's talk about the general condition of the general fund. State's tax receipts, are they above or below expectations?
Well, they've been doing very well. In fact, we had a sort of a gangbuster December, but part of that could have been due to the Federal Tax Act, which encouraged certain people to make decisions about moving expenditures of their state tax payments into December. But overall, revenues have been running above what we had assumed, and so far we're doing very well.
Do you expect any changes in May after the annual tax receipts are counted?
Yeah, once we get through with people making their final payments by April 15th, we'll know a lot more. And yet we're pretty optimistic. We think there's probably a lot of upside to the governor's revenue request, so the legislature could find itself with more money than what the governor has suggested in January.
When I was reading your report, it indicates that a lot of this growth is with personal income tax. Mm-hmm. If my math is right, and you might correct me, $4.2 billion of the $5.8 billion increase is attributable to the personal income tax. That's 72%, almost three-quarters. People don't realize sometimes that's where a lot of that money is coming from, is the personal income tax.
Well, and the personal income tax funds about 70% of all of the general fund. So we're heavily dependent on that.
Right, right. And that's another conversation.
Yeah.
But let's go on. So the economic effects with this new federal tax change on the U.S. economy in the short run, what are your expectations?
Well, I think most economic forecasters expect there to be a little bit of a boost to the economy. And that can come either from consumers having more money because of the tax cuts, or the businesses now with their corporate tax reductions and various other provisions. I think the hope is that they'll invest a lot more, which will help trigger additional growth in the economy.
So someone say that's a sugar high, but you know, will it continue on beyond this year? Question mark.
And I think that's the question of what are the possible downsides for the longer run.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, such as, is it going to help feed inflation? You've got a very tight wage labor markets, and will that sort of drive inflation as opposed
higher
to real
interest
increases?
Rates?
Higher interest rates, and of course you contributed to the federal debt, which also
counterintuitive then, right? You're doing it to heat up the economy in a way, but then it results in higher interest rates, which means it'll maybe slow down the economy.
It could dampen it. So you have to look at the net effect. And I think over the long run, you really want to look at, is it going to help business investment that makes us more productive?
Right. Okay. Let's focus on the implications for the federal tax cuts on California specifically.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of talk about this state and local taxes and the cap on that and mortgage interest deductions. It doesn't sound good for California because we have higher taxes here and higher home prices.
Yes, there are provisions on the personal income tax side at the federal level where Californians will probably do worse than other states. And that's just the things that you mentioned, because mm-hmm. we do have high state taxes and we do have high property taxes, not so much from our rate, which is actually quite low because of Proposition 13, but because our values are so high.
Right, right.
And so there will be a lot, probably a lot more Californians affected by those deductions. But you have to counter that with a lot of high-income Californians will benefit from some of the corporate and business provisions.
Yeah, I'm sure they're all looking at their tax rates and figuring out how it's all going to work out. But have they thought about that for the California, the state budget? Have they? Is that federal tax change reflected in the governor's proposal?
No, they had to put together their budget really before the final action on the federal tax plan. So when we get to the May revision, which occurs in the middle of...
Often referred to as the May revise, which apparently is grammatically incorrect.
It's the May revision, technically. But it's we know all the information, or a lot more information about income tax payments, about how many estimated payments well-to-do taxpayers are making. So we have a much better sense of revenues at that time.
So we've been talking about revenues. What about state spending? Higher or lower, and by how much?
Spending has been a little bit higher on certain areas, like healthcare spending on the poor has gone up a little bit. We had higher costs because of all the fire.
Yeah, it was reading reports, $760 million.
Yeah,
wow.
So that's a hit. We recently had some good news, though, because of action that the federal government recently took. We should have some good savings on what's called the CHIP program,
right,
which is health care for kids who don't quite, their families make a little bit too much income to qualify for Medicaid.
And there was a concern that if that didn't happen, then it would really hit California.
And they actually kept a much higher federal share, and so we're actually going to have some savings from what the governor assumed in his January budget.
Yeah, but when you think about the fires, $750 million.
That was a lot of money.
Wow.
Now, we may get reimbursed for that, but that occurs over time.
Yeah, don't count the money until it comes in, right?
That's,
I know that's your
point. That's one perspective.
Okay. Well, up next, we're going to talk about some of these constitutional set-asides for education and rainy day funds. What implications do they have for the state budget? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with the state's nonpartisan budget expert, Mac Taylor, with the Legislative Analyst Office. He is the state legislative analyst, about the governor's proposed budget. You know, there are two constitutional spending formulas. One is Prop 98, which has a minimum state funding for schools. And then there's also Prop 2, which has spending on debt payment and the rainy day fund. So how much total money needs to be set aside to meet those financial obligations?
Well, on schools, you have an overall guarantee, this sort of minimum amount, and it's composed of both property taxes and the general fund, the state general fund. The state general fund, the governor estimates, will need to spend about $55 billion for schools, K-14, through community colleges.
And that's the biggest part of the state budget,
absolutely,
right, is education.
Okay. About 40%. Mm-hmm. And that's a fairly substantial increase over the current year, so schools are getting growth in that that minimum amount. Then as far as Proposition 2 is concerned, it requires the state to set aside monies based on both overall general fund revenues and how much excess capital gains we have. And then you determine this pot of money, and half of it has to go to our rainy day fund. Right. Half of it has to go to pay off past debts.
Right.
And so the governor is estimating that those Proposition 2 requirements are about $3 billion, half to each.
Okay, let's talk about Prop 98, the education formula. What are the major components of the governor's Prop 98 spending plan this year?
Well, I think it's helpful to split it up into K-12 versus community colleges.
Right.
On the K-12 schools part...
I don't want to say K-14 because nobody knows what I'm talking
about.
It's
sort of our shorthand. But right. So elementary and secondary schools through high schools.
Right.
Most of the money that the governor's proposing is similar to what the legislature has approved in recent years. It would go to fully fund what's called the local control funding formula, which is just the way that we send monies down to schools, and they have a lot of control over how they spend it.
It's a little bump, isn't it, on school districts that have, you know, lower income students and those kinds of things, so they can help focus resources there.
In this formula, they get more money for that. So a lot of it is the governor's proposing to fully fund the targets we set about 5 years ago. So we're ahead of time in meeting those targets. And then he also proposes a big one-time sort of grant, where districts could spend the money on whatever they wanted, maintenance or, you know, other one-time things.
Yeah, but the amount of money that they're spending per student, according to your report, is $11,628 in this budget. That's a lot of money per student.
And it's been going up steadily.
Yeah, it's a big difference from what it was when he first started as governor.
Yes.
A huge difference. What else here? So let's talk about your analysis of the split between ongoing augmentations and one-time initiatives. You're calling that his approach when it comes to Prop 98 is reasonable, quote unquote. That's your term. Why do you think so?
Well, just think about school spending. If we should have a recession, if you commit all of the spending within the guarantee to ongoing programs, what do you have to do when the money turns down and you have to cut 98? You have to go into your base programs and make reductions. If you have a chunk that's for one time, that drops out, and you can support that lower level of ongoing spending without making substantial cuts to it. So it's more like it's not a reserve exactly, but it's a way to sort of help school districts make sure that they don't face the sort of abrupt reductions that we had in the last recession.
The other thing I saw was kind of interesting is that they're talking about changing the community college funding formula, which is kind of interesting. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It's a very important proposal, and I think the legislature is going to have to spend a lot of time on that. We basically give out most of the money now to community colleges, as we do to schools, just on how many people are there. Seat time.
Right.
People that come through the door. And the governor's proposing that, one, we give a substantial chunk of money based on the number of low-income or English learners, similar to what we do in K-12. And then he's also saying we should set aside about a quarter of the monies on performance. That is, if you are getting a lot of kids out with certificates and degrees, they should be rewarded and have more money than those that aren't doing well.
I don't know if I've got this right, but it sounds like community college used to be treated more like UC and CSU, and now they're being treated, the proposal is they're being treated more like K-12. Is that right, or is that?
Well, except on K-12, we give it all out on basically the formulas of the type of kids you have. There's not really a performance aspect that he's suggesting.
But the local control funding formula, kind of part of that.
That part of it is you could view as being analogous.
Okay. We've got the other one we got is Prop 2, the other constitutional spending formula, rainy day fund. Any comments about that?
Well, the governor is proposing to have total reserves of about 12% of our general fund budget. And that's the most we've had in almost forever. It is a lot. We do have a very volatile revenue structure as we keep getting back to it.
Right.
And when you have that kind of system, you need to have large reserves.
Yeah. So the governor's budget also proposes some money for various legislative initiatives and agreements. Can you give just a few quick examples?
Yeah, these are basically sort of arrangements that he had with the legislature to follow through in future years.
I promised to pay you. Here's an IOU. He's actually paying them.
It's sort of, this is the way we're going to interpret certain laws, or this is what I'm going to follow through the third year of a three-year deal. And an example of that is on child care, where a couple of years ago we said we're going to increase some rates and add some slots. We're just going to do it over time. And the governor is following through on that arrangement.
Okay. So how does the governor's plan to spend the state's discretionary dollars? How's that going to happen? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. So where does the governor want to spend those state discretionary dollars, those that exist? We're talking to the state's authoritative voice on the budget, Mac Taylor, the state's legislative analyst. So it's clear that the governor's priority in his proposed budget is growing reserves, including diverting more than is minimally required under Prop 2. How much more?
A lot.
Okay.
He had almost $7 billion in what we call discretionary monies after you pay for the constitutional things we talked about.
Right.
He puts almost half of that just in additional payments into the rainy day reserve, $3.5 billion. And what that would do is max out the amount that is required or allowed in effect under Proposition 2 at 10%. Of total general fund revenues.
It's more than actually 10, right? It actually goes up as high as 12%.
Well, the 12% is because there's another discretionary reserve that's our second rainy day, or it's our other discretionary reserve. But he maxes out what's called the basic rainy day fund that was established under Prop 2 at 10%, which is the goal that was set in that measure.
Yeah, so any money set aside for a rainy day fund means you're not spending that money for public goods and services, right? So you've made that decision. Is the governor's continued focus on reserves, is that prudent?
Well, we think so. And again, it's because of what can happen in a downturn, how quickly our fiscal situation can change, because personal income tax revenues, which again are about 70% of our overall revenues, they can head south pretty fast. Very volatile. So it's sort of what level of reserve do you want to have? And what I've told the members is I think you should have at least that 10% in the rainy day, if not more.
Okay, so that begs the question, what is the optimal level of reserves?
There is no optimal level. You have to think about, well, what kind of recession do you want to plan for? When do you think it's coming? If it's coming tomorrow, you might want to even add more money. If you think it's coming maybe now 3 or 4 years down the road, you might think of where that 12% in total that we have now is reasonable. So it sort of depends upon a lot of factors that legislators have to sort of weigh and balance.
And it's the tax system, personal income taxes in California is kind of skewed to the wealthier people are paying.
Very skewed.
And so capital gains is a big deal. And so I remember reading somewhere, you probably know better than I, but I'm sure you would, that sale of certain stocks go down can have a dramatic effect on what the state is going to get in terms of revenue.
Absolutely. Capital gains are probably the single most volatile source, but we have others too. business income, stock options, bonuses, things like that that are related to a good economy, those can also really go down.
So it's interesting, when the economy is going down, you're losing revenue and expenses would seem to be going up.
Some.
Potentially.
Yes, absolutely, and some expenses.
Yeah, that could be problematic. So let's talk a little bit about public goods and services that the governor actually would like to spend some money on. What's he proposing in terms of infrastructure and equipment?
Well, after he spends a lot, or he dedicates a lot of this discretionary money I talked about to building reserves, his next priority seems to be to spend some one-time money, which is also fairly cautious, right? You're not committing to ongoing spending.
Right.
And he spends it on infrastructure, capital outlay projects. So there's lots of new money.
Concrete.
Well, there's a lot of that. For example, he budgets the projects based on the new revenues coming in from the gas taxes that increased recently.
Yeah. I wouldn't say about the political aspects of that. If the voters are going to be voting on something in November, seeing signs up that construction's happening on roads might not be a bad idea.
And that's true. And then he's also assuming that a bond on natural resources that will be in front of the voters in June passes. And so he budgets some monies from that.
You know, I want to get into the weeds a little bit. Maybe you'll appreciate this. I was looking at what he's spending money on. One is $134 million on voting systems.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Good idea. Do the counties need this? It seems like a lot of their equipment is antiquated.
Yeah, I think that was our view, that you probably could wisely spend this on updating equipment throughout the state, especially as we move to changes in the way that we do their so-called voting centers,
which is a big change.
And so we thought the governor paying attention to that was a good idea, regardless of whether 134 is the exact amount or not.
Right. The other one I saw, this is really getting into the weeds, is $12 million for emergency communications. And I had read a study somewhere about the emergency warning system for earthquakes was about that much for California. So it looks like he's thinking about putting some money aside for some of these projects.
Well, and he puts aside money to just repair roofs on our prisons that are leaking.
Right.
And if you don't catch that, obviously you can have much more damage done in the future.
Anybody who has a home.
Oh boy,
knows
you know that.
Right. So one last quick question. Any other thoughts on the governor's key budget proposals?
Sure. I think if you think about this discretionary money, first reserves, mm-hmm. and then some one-time spending primarily on infrastructure, he did have some ongoing increases. For example, he puts almost $200 million in the courts, the operations of the courts, mm-hmm. which did get some rather steep reductions during
the
recession.
They've been asking money for a while.
They've been asking that. And he extends some of his business tax credits. And he provides money for the universities, not very much, 3% increase.
3%, he says that's enough.
And yeah. So there are some other ongoing increases.
Okay, well, up next, I want to thank Mac Taylor for that conversation. Up next, we're going to talk about the politics of the budget with Dan Walters of Cal Matters and John Myers of the LA Times. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're now joined by two well-respected observers of state politics, Dan Walters with Cal Matters and John Myers with the LA Times. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Thanks.
So, gentlemen, I'll start with you, John, first. What are your thoughts on the governor's prioritizing reserves in this budget that he's proposed?
Absolutely unsurprising. How's that for a headline? I mean, this has been the Jerry Brown playbook since he came back into office in 2011, which is try to restrain in some ways, and I want to be careful there because he has spent more money, the state has spent more money every year, but restrain the growth in spending, try to find ways to put money aside for the eventual recession. That's why he had voters pass Prop 2 in 2014 that expanded the size of that rainy day fund. And so, no, not surprising at all that the governor would say, let's shove more of the current windfall, the projected windfall rather, into the reserve fund.
So is it prudent or just overly risk averse?
Prudent and overly risk-averse. Sounds like a Jerry Brownism if I've ever heard one. I'd say it's prudent because it's still risky. The rainy day fund maxes out about $13.5 billion. And he's, by his own arithmetic, a mild recession would cost him $60 billion over 3 years. So the rainy
which
day
is what
fund,
was happening before, right? We were having $20 billion deficits right. during the Great Recession.
Yeah, about a 20% decline, give or take. And so even with all the money he wants to put aside, the state could still be in a big, deep doo-doo should we get a recession. Now, I think the more interesting thing is the rainy day fund will hit its max this next year.
Which is 10%.
10%. And also school funding hits a max, which means that if the state gets extra money in the kitty, as the alleged analyst, as your guest has probably told you they would, then that money becomes kind of unrestricted. In other words, it doesn't have to go to schools. It doesn't have to go into reserves. So it makes it a more difficult thing for Jerry Brown to divert that into reserves, because he's got all these Democratic legislators wanting to spend it on child care and welfare grants and all sorts of new maybe even health care for undocumented immigrants. Lots of plans kicking around that would cost billions of dollars of new entitlements that would be difficult to reduce if you do get a recession. And so will Jerry Brown stand up to that heat, or will he cave in?
Yeah, a little bit like a feeding frenzy, it sounds like. So let me ask you this. Talking about education, he's fully funded the local control funding formula 2 years ahead of schedule. So can you say mission accomplished?
No, because we don't know whether it works or not. And there's many strong indications that it doesn't work, or it hasn't made any demonstrable improvement in the academic performance of the kids it's supposed to help, i.e. poor kids and English learners. Money by itself doesn't do anything if it doesn't actually do the job, and we don't know that it's done the job. We may not know for years whether it's done the job.
And that's assuming it stays on the books, that another governor doesn't come and rethink the way that we fund schools, because that, I think, is a real fear of some education advocates, even if they don't love the formula, that the next governor may not be committed to that kind of idea.
What about community colleges and the money he's setting aside? Good idea, bad idea?
Well, I mean, certainly he's following through what the legislature did last year, which was this first year of community colleges essentially free. He's found the money in the budget for it. Again, there's a surplus of money there. Governor has talked a lot about the changing face of higher education. I don't know exactly how that's going to shake out once you talk about it. He's talked about online ideas beyond the community college. But clearly there's a lot of support for that, and it's really not that expensive in context of the rest of the budget. I think it's probably going to happen easily.
Okay, let's talk about higher education, CSU and UC. 3%, he's saying that's enough. They're saying we want a tuition increase.
Well, they're saying, yeah, and it's the usual kabuki dance, as Arnold Schwarzenegger liked to call it, where the colleges threaten a tuition increase if they don't get more money from Sacramento, and they go Sturm und Drang, and all sorts of horrible things are going to happen, and then the legislature and the governor have to decide whether they want to cave into that and give them some more money so they won't have a tuition increase. And it goes on every year, and this is just, it's more of the same, so to speak. But I think underlying that is, in both the community colleges and the four-year schools, is California isn't producing enough college graduates. And so,
like a million short a year or something?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. It's a combination of demography. In other words, baby boomers retiring out of the labor force, mm-hmm. plus the changing nature of the economy requiring more education. And so we're falling short on college graduates in California. And then a not inconsiderable factor is that if you get your degree in California, can you find a place to live? And yeah. So sometimes you take, the kids want to take their kids, graduates, whether they're kids or not, want to take their degrees to Texas or someplace else where they can afford to live.
We spend the money educating them, and then they leave.
That's right.
John, I want to ask you, so Dan was talking about we may have more money coming in. Analysts also said the same thing. You think it's going to be a food fight over, spending that on new programs?
I don't know. I mean, if you look at the conventional wisdom in the past, you would say, yes, there's going to be pretty intense debates about some of this. I think you see leaders of the legislature, Democrats, who have said that the governor's budget is only that. It's an opening offer, and that they want to negotiate more. They don't think that some of those social services programs have ever come back fully where they need to be. They've talked about child care. They've talked about the expansion, I should say, of the earned income tax credit for California, which has had a lot of success by some of the data there. I think there is going to be an interesting discussion, but I will say that all the volatility we've been seeing recently on Wall Street and stocks, those are the people who those capital gains, that's where the money comes from in California. So I think it should be cautious about how much of it you spend in the early part of 2018.
Being prudent. I want to thank John Myers of LA Times and Dan Walters from CalMatters, as well as Mac Taylor from the California Legislative Analyst Office, for joining us. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or log on to our website to get the Maddie Daily at MaddieInstitute.org.
Up next, what impact will the state's improving finances and the governor's budget mean for the Valley? We'll talk to Mike Dunbar, the editorial page editor of the Modesto Bee and Merced Sun Star, and California State University Bakersfield professor Ivy Cargyle.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
So what does the governor's budget mean for the San Joaquin Valley? We'll get some diverse perspectives from our panel. Mike Dunbar, the editorial page editor of the Modesto Bee and the Merced Sun Star, and Professor Ivy Cargyle, with California State University Bakersfield. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Great. So Mike, let me start with you. What do you think, what impact do you think the recent federal tax cuts are going to have on Valley counties and cities?
Well, it's kind of hard to say exactly what impact will be on the cities. I think a lot of our local residents are going to like it. I think people here in the Valley are actually seeing a little bit more money in their paychecks, and I think they're enjoying that. And I think it is being noticed. I think as far as the cities and counties go, it's going to be down the road before we start seeing the impacts. I mean, this budget is going to draw, it's going to put a $1 trillion hole in our deficit, and that's going to drive up interest rates.
You're not a believer that this is going to, you know, increase the gross national product, you know, 3% a year, what they're talking about, and it's going to pay for itself?
No, it's first off, no one believes that. No credible economist believes that. I don't think even the politicians believe it. But we do know that if the laws of economics hold true, that it will drive up interest rates, and that's going to put a damper on some of the infrastructure projects that we're just beginning to see happen here in the Valley. We've delayed a lot of our infrastructure, our road projects, other big projects, and, you know, building projects, and it's going to delay them because it's going to cost us more, because we're going to be paying higher interest rates.
Right. That's one of the things that's been going on for quite a while now is low interest rates. So it's cheaper for cities and counties to borrow money. And if interest rates go up, that's going to change that dynamic. So, Professor Cargill, what is your impression of the federal tax cuts? How is it playing in Bakersfield, in Kern County?
Well, I think, you know, out here, it's a wait-and-see game, right? I mean, people are excited about, you know, the small bumps that they're seeing in their paychecks, as was previously noted. However, you know, there is concern about what's going to happen down the line, and particularly with infrastructure and how and what effect that's going to have, given that where we're located in California. So I think, you know, I think reactions are mixed right now.
You know, Kern County is a pretty conservative area. You know, you think, you know, deficits are a big thing for conservatives. No concern about that trillion-plus hole that this may create in the federal deficit?
Well, people are definitely not excited about that. However, there's the expectation that there's going to be other ways to ameliorate that.
And that means, I think what you're saying is cutting programs, cutting spending.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, if we think about the 2019 budget that just that the Trump administration released, and all of the different cuts that are being made, I mean, you know, you make it up in that respect.
Yeah, most of the cuts though are in the social programs. They're not asking for cuts in military spending. Actually, they're going to be increasing spending in military, and that's the other big part of the budget. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, just a couple of different areas, right, that we know that the Trump administration is looking to actually increase spending. But for the most part, when it comes to the social safety net, that's where the cuts are going to come in.
Yeah. So let's turn our attention to the state budget. You know, Mike, Governor Brown is focusing really in this budget on building reserves, an extra $3.5 billion into the rainy day fund, bringing that total reserve up to $16 billion. You know, just as a footnote, you know, when he first started, he came into office seeing about $20 billion deficits annually. So he's got $16 billion set aside, so almost enough for a year if we have another downturn. But is he setting aside too much money? I mean, money that could be used to address Valley, you know, challenges like lack of infrastructure you were talking about earlier.
Well, we vehemently disagree with the governor on water issues here in the Modesto-Merced region. But we pretty much agree with his emphasis on rainy day. In fact, I'd like to see it even go higher. And the reason I'd like to see it go higher is I agree with the governor in his almost paranoia that we're going to see a significant downturn. And with California's dependence on income tax, it's always boom or bust. I mean, when he came in, I'm trying to remember what his budget was. It was around $85 billion, something like that. Mm-hmm. I, you know, for discretionary, and it's now up to like 125, somewhere in that range.
Right.
So he needs to have, I think, a significant rainy day fund. I'd like to see it go to 25% of the budget. As far as the infrastructure spending, Merced and Stanislaus County both joined the ranks of the self-help counties within the last 2 years.
You might want to explain what that is.
And, well, they voted to tax themselves through a sales tax, and I think it's a quarter of a cent in both, might be a half.
And that's for transportation?
I've forgotten already. And for transportation spending.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're beginning to see a lot of plans developed and come to fruition, and when there's money to be spent like this, especially money that can be bonded out, you begin to see more cooperation. You begin to see people, you know, prioritize and actually work together to get things done. So we're seeing that right now.
Yeah,
and I'd like to see it continue, but it won't if the budget goes bust.
Well, the idea of a self-help tax actually makes a lot of sense. We did that in Fresno County. They have something called Measure C. And the point there is that you can leverage local dollars against federal and state dollars, and so you can get a bigger bang for the buck. If you don't have those funds to leverage, then you typically, when those grants come out, you're less competitive. So you know, does that happen? I'm wondering, in Kern County, are they a self-help jurisdiction? Do you know?
No. Not as of yet.
Yeah, but they may see the money going to other places. They may decide, you know, maybe it's a good idea to move in that direction. Well, I want to ask, you know, follow up on what Mike was saying and then come back to Mike about this reserve. You're saying 25% set aside. You know, that means that money is parked and it's not being used, right? So, Professor Cargill, what do you think about that? I mean, the state says they want to put aside 10% in kind of a rainy day fund. But the governor said, no, I'm actually going to put aside 12% with the $16 billion. Right. That's what it works out to. Too much, too little, just right?
Well, I mean, you know, going to piggyback off what was already stated, you know, given and thinking about, you know, the first question you asked in regards to the tax cuts and the budget, you know, at first I thought, yeah, you know, it is perhaps too much money. We, especially given that, you know, I work at a Cal State, and the fact that, you know, the budget that was initially proposed for the Cal States wasn't met, and Governor Brown actually is providing less funds, and I'm just thinking about our situation at Cal State Bakersfield. It makes me think, well, yeah, maybe it is too little money. However, it's too much money. However, you know, that boom, you know, California's boom and bust economy is something we have to think about. And given the cuts that are coming down the pike, and if the proposed budget is passed, I'm just thinking about just, you know, simple programs like CalFresh and how reliant people in the Central Valley are on that, and what that's going to mean in regards to having to use some of that rainy day money to help feed people.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be a lot more people who are food insecure. So perhaps it isn't too much after all. And you know, we just don't know what's going to, you know, California is very, is in very uncertain terrain. Yes, it's been one of the states that's been on the forefront of resisting the Trump agenda. However, we're starting to realize more and more how reliant we are on federal dollars. And given that part of the equation, I'm wondering if maybe it's not enough.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, Professor Cargill. You were talking about, you know, the Cal State and the money they're receiving. You know, of course, the governor is giving money to CSU, a small bump up to CSU and UC, but he's saying don't increase tuition. That's the kind of the quid pro quo. But what he is giving a lot of money,
right,
though, to K-12 and community colleges. What do you think of the governor's decision to fully fund the local control funding formula? Good or bad for the Valley?
It can be good. I think it can be good. I think the intent behind setting up local control funding formula was this idea of being able to provide more transparency so that people will know how it is that school districts get money. However, you know, as with every new program, you know, it's been 40 years since, you know, the area of education has actually, California education has actually looked at its funding mechanisms. And everything, you know, it's a good idea. I think it's great that that he's providing more funding for it, and it can be very helpful for the Valley because this is still an area that you know, that still has high levels of poverty and low levels of education.
Right.
And so in that respect, I think it can be really good for purposes of retaining students, of helping students get through and you know, continue closing the high school graduation gap between white, Latino, African-American, and Asian students. And I think in terms of the community colleges, yeah, I mean, it can be really good. It's just, it definitely needs to be looked at, and it definitely needs to be tweaked, because as of now, the school districts have a lot of flexibility with how they use the money. We're already starting to see in some school districts like LA Unified and Long Beach Unified in down south, where they're being sued because of the misallocation of funds.
But they're spending the money, are they spending the money on teacher salaries as opposed to helping the disadvantaged, economically disadvantaged students those funds are supposed to be targeted toward?
Right. So the funds are supposed to be targeting, you know, low income English learners, you know, those groups that need the money. However, what they're discovering is that what the school districts are doing is using it to plug holes with pensions and using it to plug holes with teacher salaries and such. That's not to say that the teachers don't need this. I mean, teachers are severely underpaid. However, there does need to be that flexibility that is currently there needs to be restructured.
Yeah, well,
it needs to be structured.
They do call it's a local control funding formula, so with an emphasis on local.
Right.
You know, Mike, let me ask you, the governor's proposing more money for high school career and technical education, about $212 million, and a lot more money for community colleges for deferred maintenance. There's $275 million for that. There's $120 million for a fully online community college. He also wants to change how community colleges are funded, kind of following that same local control funding formula that he has for K-12. The Valley is well documented, has a lack of skilled workers. Is this going to make the Valley more competitive?
Well, I'm not sure what makes the Valley more competitive in terms of that. And I'm a huge fan of community colleges. And I, you know, if you look around at what Modesto Junior College, which is part of the Yosemite Community College District, has done, I mean, they have one of the best ag programs in the nation at that level. They have a phenomenal nursing program. But I worry that some community colleges become calcified in their approach to education, and we have waiting lists for basic courses. We end up having to, people need 4 years, 3 years, 4 years to complete their AA degrees because they simply can't get the courses they need. So I'm concerned about that. And so I think additional money would help. But additional money only helps if the administration of these colleges are willing to apply it in ways that eliminate the waiting list, that put the money where it does the most good. And as far as online, I think if they're working with the existing community colleges, I think an online college would be a great way to help eliminate those waiting lists so that you can get your degree not necessarily from an online college, but from one of your local community. I mean, what are there, 115 of them out there?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be a great way to do it. But one of the most significant things, I know several people who are adjunct professors who teach at these community colleges, and they're treated horribly. A lot of them are driving from Modesto to Merced. They've got an hour to get from Modesto to Merced, hour and a half, so they can teach courses at both so they can afford to pay their bills. I mean, these are people who have invested a lot of money in their education. And here they are driving up and down the valley from Delta to Modesto to Merced up to Columbia just so they can teach enough classes to make ends meet.
Yeah, and that's becoming...
So there's a lot of things wrong.
Yeah, that's become an issue, I think, certainly at the CSU and maybe in the UCs as well. Frankly, you know, some of these lecturers, part-time lecturers, aren't paid as much. They don't receive benefits. And they're struggling, you know, to fill up their schedule. So they're driving here, there, and everywhere. Before we get off this topic, I want to give Professor Cargill the last comment about this emphasis on community college and career technical education. Your quick thoughts on that?
So I was a when I was doing my grad work, I was a professor at a community college, and I completely, agree with everything you all are saying about how adjuncts are treated. I mean, something so simple as not even having office space for office hours is extremely problematic, especially when you have, difficult subjects that you're teaching, like chemistry or math or something like that. But yeah, so I definitely agree that, the community colleges do need more funding, and I think that the idea of having these programs that are going to provide, a career, technical services for students are actually really great. They can be very helpful for the Valley because they can be the impetus for job creation.
Yeah, it's often what you hear from employers is it's not we don't have jobs, we just don't have the skilled workers to do those jobs. Well, when we come back, we're going to have a more discussion on how the governor's state budget might impact the Valley. That conversation in a moment. This is the Mattie Report.
You're listening to the Mattie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking about the governor's proposed budget and what it may mean for the Valley with California State University Bakersfield professor Ivy Cargile and Mike Dunbar, the editorial page editor for the Modesto Bee and Merced Sun Star. So, Mike, let me start with you. What do you think about the governor's plans on spending some of these one-time monies on things like trial court construction? He's got $375 million for that. Voting systems, because there's a new voting system, voting centers, which is going to be coming out in the next few years, $134 million for that. Correctional facilities, $136 million for that. And what do you think of some of those proposals? Good idea, bad idea?
Well, I think they're great. I wonder if they're enough. Modesto was on the short list for a new courthouse. In fact, we acquired all the land here in Modesto and turned it over to the state, and then nothing happened because the money dried up. So what was there were these condemned buildings. They had been vacated. Vagrants moved in. They turned into drug shooting galleries.
Where a courthouse was supposed to be, they turned into drug...
They had several buildings and they put fences around them, but the homeless, they get through the fences, and they were in the buildings. I went down there to look at one day, and there was a woman in clear mental distress, had to call to get her help from behavioral services. But so the mayor of our city, Ted Branvold, complained to the state. I think he complained. He made a phone call. And fairly soon, the state came in and knocked that building down. So now we've got a big vacant lot, which is better than having a shooting gallery. So we had to have, we have to have this money to complete some of these projects. Our courthouses are in many cases dilapidated. Modesto certainly is, and so that kind of thing is necessary. As far as new voting systems, one word, DOS.
Oh boy. you have some concerns?
Yeah, I have a lot of concerns. I mean, I wrote about these concerns years ago when we went to the fully electronic voting systems here, and when that happened, I went to a permanent absentee voter because I want my ballot on paper. I want my ballot to be recorded on paper. And so it can be checked. I know that all of our county registrars insist that our systems have never been hacked, and I believe them. I believe our county registrars are good, competent, doing excellent work. But I also believe that there are people in Russia and probably China and elsewhere working assiduously to try to find ways to circumvent all of our safeguards. And it does bother me, and yes, I'm a little paranoid perhaps, but I think we need to upgrade these systems and make them more foolproof and keep them independent from each other so that if you're going to have to break into, if you want to sway the election in California, you're going to need to sway every county and not just one system. So, yeah, I think we need to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're actually, with this whole voting center thing, is they're also moving more toward mail-in ballots. So, it's interesting that, we've advanced technology to the point where it's actually not as good as what we had before with the paper ballots. So, Professor Cargo, what are your thoughts on some of these capital expenditures that the governor's focusing on, like trial court construction and voting systems and things of that nature?
I'm in agreement with Mike. I think it's definitely something that it's money that is well spent. I mean, to think about dilapidated courthouses or to think about growing counties that need more courthouses. Yeah, we need to invest in those areas. We need to be able to have money for the services that are provided in the court system. In terms of like refurbishing, you know, the systems and having them become more technologically sound, to have money in order to be able to provide the assistance that people need in terms of being able to provide interpreters. All of that, I think, is definitely money well spent, because otherwise, you know, the legal system can be very complicated. And so, you know, having the resources that are necessary to make that system a little bit easier, I think, is definitely a good idea.
Yeah, because there's a cost involved, yeah. Right? And if people are incarcerated waiting for trial, you know, citizens are paying for that money while they're incarcerated. It just those expenses do add up. But let me ask you this, Professor Cargill. What about the governor's other spending plans? He's got some one-time expenses for things like trial court construction. There's $375 million for that. But there's also stuff specifically for the Valley, but for businesses, like $200 million in business tax credits that a lot of Valley businesses could probably use. I was looking at $210 million for trial court operations, which we talked about. And then you've got $92 million for UC and CSU, another $131 million for counties to address incompetent to stand trial wait list, another $40 million for the 2020 census. I mean, there's some money he's sprinkling out on these different projects. Do any of them have any impact or are going to be significant for the Valley?
I'm going to start off with, I think there are. I think there are definitely business tax credits are always helpful, but, you know, you always want to make sure that, I mean, you know, the business sector helps keep the economy alive, and we definitely need that in the cities that are here in the Central Valley. But also, too, I think the money allocated for the, you know, I'll go back to something that I talked about earlier, the money to the UCs and the CSUs. I mean, if we think about CSU Bakersfield, if we think about Fresno State, if we think about UC Merced and the other institutions, CSU and UC institutions that are here in the Valley, Stanislaus and so forth,
right.
You know, there are resources are needed. And you know, a lot of the students that attend, at least particularly in my experience at CSU Bakersfield, a lot of our students are homegrown.
Right.
We need to be able to provide them the resources that they need in order not only to stay at CSUB and keep that retention, but also to graduate and go out and make their community better in however they see that is.
Can I follow that up to that point? Actually, you know, I know that at Cal State Fresno State, we have the greatest retention of students in our service area of any CSU. In other words, CSUs are primarily responsible for their immediate area, like Fresno State would be the four-county area of Madera, Fresno, Kingston, Tulare. We have the greatest retention rate of people, once they graduate, staying in our area. And I'm willing to bet the same thing is probably true of Cal State Bakersfield and Cal State Stanislaus.
Yes, it is. So, and these students want to stay here, and they want to use their degrees to make their communities better. And as such, I think that, you know, I think it's important that the state provide, you know, invest in our communities. This is another way for the state to invest in the communities by funding these institutions and making sure that the resources that they need are there for purposes of them, you know, turning out and becoming better citizens. I mean, we're learning more and more that a bachelor's degree is just the beginning, right?
Right.
People are now competitive. You're going to need higher education. I mean, one of the reasons why Amazon didn't choose this area to put their headquarters was because of the fact that they didn't think that there were enough young, educated individuals.
Right. And what the research shows is the Valley towns are among the least educated in the nation. And so having, you know, more access to CSUs and community colleges, for that matter, makes a difference. Mike, we've only got a minute left. You get the last word.
The last word. Well, I think that we have to find ways to not only just fund the colleges, but we have to find ways to create better jobs in our communities. You know, you're not going to keep the so-called best and brightest. They're not going to want to stay here if the only things that we're offering them are the same jobs that their grandparents did. I mean, there's a lot of them who want to be farmers, and that's great because farming is no longer a low-skill field, so to speak. You have to be smart, and you have to be able to use every resource at your disposal to be a good farmer. But there has to be only 3% of our population farms. So you've got to have a lot of good jobs, a lot of jobs that require people to think and to act and to innovate. And I'm concerned that we're not seeing those kind of jobs being developed here in our valley. And that's what we have to put money into. We have to find ways to bring those jobs here and to incentivize people to put those jobs here.
Yeah, and it would seem, you know, just to kind of follow up on your point, you know, the PPIC, Public Policy Institute of California, saying that we're going to be about 1 million college graduates short by 2030. And I would think, since the college level going rates are lowest in the valley, in the entire state, the low-hanging fruit, no pun intended, is right here. If you want to increase those numbers, get more of those kids to think about college. And so I think we'll leave it there. I want to thank our guests, Mike Dunbar, the editorial page editor of Modesto Bee and the Merced Sun Star, and California State University Baker School professor Ivy Cargill. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
The views and opinions expressed on the Matter Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.